film 2001, A Space Odyssey, directed by Stanley Kubrick and written by him and Arthur C. Clarke, spans 4 million years from man's emergence out of apes to a contemporary period only one generation removed from today and ending with the birth of a new man of the future. There are three casts of characters. The apes, with emphasis on Moonwatcher, the first monkey to grasp the idea of a tool. Men of the Year 2001 is exemplified by scientist Administrator Haywood Floyd, the first man to wrestle with the absolute certainty of a far-advanced extraterrestrial intelligence. And the crew of Spaceship Discovery, contemporaries of Floyd, who are sent on the longest space flight ever dared, in quest of that extraterrestrial life. Astronaut Dave Bowman alone survives the trip, and it is he who undergoes metamorphosis into a new kind of human being. The film ends as this new man returns to Earth, his starting place. In his book version of 2001, Arthur Clarke calls him the Star Child. Ape, man, Superman. 2001, A Space Odyssey is a film about man's past and future. The turning points are marked by the monoliths. Identical black slabs about 10 feet high. The monoliths are artifacts from another world, a world intent on nurturing mankind. All the advanced technology in 2001, the friction grip slippers for walking in zero gravity, the voice print identification machine, the huge orbiting space station between Earth and Moon, the advanced computer that runs Discovery, even the feasibility of a trip to Jupiter, all are reasonable extensions of what we know now. The monoliths are not. They are objects made by a non-earthly civilization put in man's path to guide him toward higher development. Extraterrestrial life, its possibilities and mathematically speaking its certainty, lie at the core of 2001. Kubrick had been interested in the subject for a long time. When the film was started, he had a separate unit shoot interviews with leading chemists, theologians, and astronomers about extraterrestrial life. Their statements were edited down to a 10-minute prologue for the film itself, which would have made clear the movie's preoccupation with other modes of being. The prologue was dropped. There are four monoliths in the film. The first, 4 million years ago. One day at dawn, man's dawn arrives. When first encountered, these ancestors of man are vegetarians, sharing the meager fruits of an uncomfortable world with a race of sluggish tapirs. They are in danger, though this is not spelled out, of extinction. The fact that this vital point is not spelled out sets the style for the whole film. This is what the film's detractors have called willful obscurity. They also resent the film's use or misuse of language. Almost a humorous promise of more to come. The film has few spoken words, and most of what it has are only advanced versions of the friendly grunt.
Oh, I really must be going.
Well, I hope that you and your wife can come to the IAC conference in June.
Well, we're going to try. I hope we can make it.
If you do, you remember to bring that darling little daughter with you.
Well, that'll all depend on the school vacations and all that sort of thing.
Well, I know you will all want to join with me in welcoming our distinguished friend and colleague from the
X-ray Delta One. This is Mission Control. Roger, you're 2013.
I tried, Kubrick said, to work things out so that nothing important was said in the dialogue. An early version of 2001 did have some narrative explanation. Here is a literary signpost for what happens to Moonwatcher after being exposed to the first monolith. This is the discarded original narration. As he looks out now upon a hostile world, there is already something in his gaze beyond the capacity of any ape. A dawning awareness, the first intimations of an intelligence. Homo erectus becomes the new Homo sapiens. The first tool is invented.
Thank you.
who did not experience the monolith are immediately at a disadvantage in the battle for survival, as symbolized by the squabble over a water hole. Is one group now man and the other ape? Charles Darwin once wrote, "In a series of forms graduating insensibly from some ape-like creature to man as he now exists, it would be impossible to fix on any definite point where the term man ought to be used." And the process continues. This single primitive tool will lead to even more sophisticated tools. 4 million years of slow but inevitable development are represented by Kubrick in one abrupt cut to the beginning of the 21st century, the longest flash forward in cinema history. Many of the apes, incidentally, are ballet dancers. Their costumes are the most realistic monkey suits ever attempted. Asked why 2001 didn't win an Academy Award for these costumes, Clark quipped, the judges didn't think they were costumes. Clothing in 2001, like the technological hardware, tends to be subdued, plausible, futuristic, but not fantastic. The stewardesses, streamlined chic. Compared to Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon, astronauts Bowman and Poole are drab. Without remembering tea dances or films about Vienna under the Habsburgs. For them, this music is elegant, cool, meticulously structured. Music to fly through space by. The star of the film's second cast of characters. Heywood Floyd is going to the moon with a change of planes and an orbiting space station to inspect an object. It turns out to be the second monolith, which has been discovered by the men of the American moon base, Clavius. To the select few scientists who've been appraised of the situation, the nature of the discovered object proves that life from another world once visited our moon. They fear severe culture shock if the Earth's population finds this out too abruptly. In the cockpit, small screens show systems display, and three computerized readouts aid the pilots in docking. Few will notice, but these readouts are fairly accurate, including guidance corrections. Kubrick was extremely careful with such details. There were hardly any errors, shortcuts, or exaggerations of what is considered feasible by the end of the century. General Electric, IBM, Honeywell, RCA, the British Atomic Energy Commission, and dozens of other organizations assisted Kubrick's advisors in planning these details. Scientific accuracy can be objectively evaluated, but the designs also had to be aesthetically convincing. Accompanying Kubrick and his design staff to a news set one day, Clark murmured that it reminded him of a Chinese restaurant. Kubrick said that it killed it for him instantly and ordered revisions. In his diary, Clark noted, "Must keep away from design department for a few days." Heywood Floyd is traveling in Orion, an ordinary spaceship for commutation between Earth and the orbiting station. The interior scenes are sets, life-size, but the exterior view is a model only about this big. A model made with extreme care. It not only had to look real in close-ups, it also had to conform to what engineers consider to be the necessary features of such a ship. Half an hour into the film, the long-awaited first words of human dialogue.
Here you are, Sam. May you level, please?
Dr. Floyd's deathless answer.
Hi. You're on the way back.
Bye.
Mundaneness is Kubrick's technique to keep the thrust of the story utterly believable, to give a tremendous parable, a local habitation, and a name. Familiar trademarks assumed to exist a generation from now. Inventions are required to look absolutely commonplace. Life goes on. This is one of the three bathrooms in the film. On the space station, Floyd speaks via picturephone to his child, actually Kubrick's own daughter, and lies to a group of amiable Russian scientists.
Well, Dr. Floyd, I hope you don't think I'm being too inquisitive, but perhaps you can clear up the great big mystery about what has been going on up there.
I'm afraid I don't know what you mean.
Quite frankly, we have had some very reliable...
Actually, he's deliberately perpetuating a rumor of epidemic on the U.S. moon base, a cover story to account for the base being incommunicado and keep the Russians from finding out the truth, the uncovered monolith.
This is, in fact, what has happened. Epidemic could quite easily spread to our base.
We should, like everything else, as usual. Later aboard Ares, the shuttle from the space station to the moon, Floyd enjoys one of the many artificial food meals served up in 2001. In zero gravity, the stewardess nonchalantly walks up the plane's circular wall. This scene was made by shooting through a set made of two separate cylindrical rooms. The actress is walking in place on the floor of the far room, while the room in front with the camera fixed to it rotates. Then she takes a couple of real steps and exits, apparently upside down. The landing of Ares. The ship itself is a photograph here. Its lit windows are separate projections. Together they were filmed and then superimposed on a background film showing moonscape and distant Earth. For the descent of Ares into the airlock at the Clavius moon base, a 2-foot diameter model was lowered into a 15-foot set. The illusion of great size is aided by the film projections matted into the airlock's glass windows. The eye sees those people as normal size and magnifies everything else accordingly. Floyd on his way to the site of the unearthed monolith. The moon bus hears a photograph of projected window scenes. It was moved inch by inch on an animation stand while the camera pulled back over a lunar landscape. A table, 6 feet deep, with craters and hills as molded cutouts in false perspective.
Oh, anybody hungry?
There's more eating. Food is a recurring theme in 2001. And there's more painfully real, banal dialogue.
What's that, chicken?
Something like that. Tastes the same, anyway.
Got any ham?
2001 owes the essence of its plot and a great deal of its overall form and painstaking detail to co-author Arthur Clarke. The idea of projecting man's face from the distant past into the hazy future, for example, might be traced to Clarke's early infatuation with Olaf Stapleton's classic book, Last and First Men, with its astonishing time charts. Clarke has long been interested in the parallels between the journeys of the ancient Greeks and the exploration of outer space, and the metaphor of Odysseus was in the film virtually from the start. Three of Clarke's own works certainly stand immediately behind the plot of 2001. Space visitors meet Ape-Man in his short story, Expedition to Earth, written in 1950. In The Sentinel, written that same year, Earthmen find an object on the moon that is a burglar alarm planted there by extraterrestrials to warn them when man reaches the capability for space travel. And in Clarke's novel, Childhood's End, man undergoes a complete physical metamorphosis. The extraterrestrial burglar alarm is what Hayward Floyd finds on the moon. It is the second monolith. It was dug up during the 2-week lunar night. The first sharp light of lunar day is seen creeping toward the excavation. This scene, the turning point of the whole story, was the first scene Kubrick filmed. And sends a squealing radio signal that is tracked to the vicinity of Jupiter. film cuts at once to the spaceship bound for Jupiter. As originally released, the film did not have this title slide. The cut was made wholly without literary signposts. Aboard Discovery, astronauts Bowman and Poole alternate duties while three colleagues, due to be awakened when the ship reaches Jupiter, are held in suspended animation, their life support systems monitored automatically by Hal, the computer that runs the ship. Hal, who had in earlier versions of the script been a female machine named Athena and a man-shaped robot named Socrates, received his name from the phrase heuristic algorithmic, words descriptive of certain computer functions. Hal is said by Clark not to have been derived by moving the letters IBM each one position backward in the alphabet, though he and Kubrick professed delight with the coincidence. For exterior views of Discovery, a 54-foot model was built, and a 15-footer for long shots. The interior is a huge centrifuge which in real space travel would rotate, throwing the inhabitants gently to the outside wall. This would simulate a little gravity. This rotating centrifuge was actually built for the film by Vickers Aircraft in England. It looked like a Ferris wheel. As it turned at 3 miles an hour, the camera turned with it and was adjusted to keep the actor always in the picture. And there are the little Kubrick touches to make space travel as mundane as it will, of course, be.
Anyway, Queen takes pawn.
Bishop takes knight's pawn.
A lovely move. Rook to king one.
I'm sorry,
chess has been a Kubrick lifelong passion. Queen, a matching in-joke for Clark's benefit took place queen. Earlier when the Russian lady scientist supposed that her husband was still diving at the bottom of the sea. Diving is Clark's passion.
Yeah, looks like you're right.
Cool. Life Aboard Discovery furthers the film's concern with the use, disuse, and abuse of words. Of the ship. Nearly every line of the dialogue is disingenuous, at some remove from the truth. Astronauts Bowman and Poole are first heard in conversation, not with each other, but in a fictitiously cheerful interview with the BBC.
What's it like living for the better part of a year in such close proximity with Hal?
Well, it's pretty close to what you said about him earlier. He is just like a sixth member of the crew. Very quickly get adjusted to the idea that he talks, and you think of him really just as another person.
Parents speak to their son. The agony of one-way conversation.
Happy birthday. Many happy returns of the day.
Happy birthday, Hal.
Yeah, Mother and I are both feeling wonderful, too. Ray and Sally were going to be here, too, but at the last minute, Ray's back. What's that on him again?
How do you like the cake, dear?
Looks great, doesn't it? Sorry you can't join us.
Yeah.
Oh, I ran
analyses, indirections, mumbling.
All my students made me promise to send their best wishes, too. You know, they talk about you all the time in the classroom. Frank, you're a big celebrity in the second grade. You know, we were on television last week.
Oh, yes. Your mother and I, in days past, were interviewed about what we thought of our illustrious son. You can imagine what we told them. I think it's being broadcast next Thursday. Perhaps you'll be able to listen in.
Oh, we were thrilled about Elaine and Bill, dear. I'll be glad to get the present for you, but please tell me how much I can spend.
Oh, yes, Frank, about your AGS 19 payments, I think I've straightened it out for you. I talked to the accounting office in Houston yesterday, and they said that you should be receiving your higher rates of pay by next month.
In a world of contrived communication, it is, fittingly, the threat of a very real breakdown in the ship's communication link with Earth that triggers the denouement of the Discovery mission and the final phase of the story.
It's a bit silly. Just a moment. I've just picked up a fault in the AE-35 unit. It's going to go 100% failure within 72 hours.
But Mission Control double-checks.
Mission Control. Roger, you're 1930. We concur with your plan to replace number one unit to check fault prediction. We should advise you, however, that our preliminary findings indicate that your onboard 9000 computer is in error predicting the fault. I say again, in error predicting the fault. I know this sounds rather incredible, but this conclusion is based on results from our twin 9000 computer. We are skeptical ourselves, and we are running cross-checking routines to determine reliability of this conclusion. Sorry about this little snag, fellas, and we'll get this info to you just as soon as we work it out. X-ray Delta 1, this is Mission Control. 2049er, cleanse. Mission concluded.
The only dialogue in which men speak heart to heart takes place when Bowman and Poole are finally driven to confess their distrust of Hal and the possibility of disconnecting
him. Let's say we put the unit back and it doesn't fail, huh? That would pretty well wrap it up as far as Hal is concerned, wouldn't it?
Well, we'd be in very serious trouble.
We would, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell can we do?
Well, we wouldn't have too many alternatives.
I don't think we'd have any alternatives. There isn't a single aspect of ship operations that's not under his control. If he were proven to be malfunctioning, I wouldn't see how we'd have any choice but disconnection.
I'm afraid I agree with you.
There'd be nothing else to do.
And it is this communication that seals their fate. Hal, programmed to be as human as possible, develops an ego and decides to kill his crew. Poole is destroyed as he attempts to fix the antenna. Hibernating astronauts are murdered when Bowman impulsively goes after Poole. And Hal then denies Bowman readmittance to the ship.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
First, it is Bowman's turn to betray the indelible marks of man's lowly origin in the beast.
Hal. Hal. Hal.
Then when Bowman succeeds in forcing his way in through the manually operated hatch and lobotomizes Hal, it is the machine's turn to betray his lowly origins in man. Kubrick first wrote to Clark in 1964, suggesting a collaboration on a science fiction film. It had been a year since Gordon Cooper's brief trip in Mercury 9. NASA was spending every day the film's entire budget. Although the inevitability of space travel had been discussed, few people could imagine its reality. Marshall McLuhan says, "Man, as yet, has no means of imagining the nature of his own experience in space. Until artists have provided him with adequate forms to express what he feels in space, he will not know the meaning of the experience." The last section of the film gives form to a phenomena still wholly beyond man's direct experience. Kubrick insists that we simply continue to believe our eyes. And Clark's third law states that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Bowman approaches, in a pod, the homing in point for the Jupiter mission. His journey has been dubbed by fans the trip. Not for its progress through distance, we have no idea of the distances involved, but because he and we must flow freely with it. The film's third monolith appears, spectacularly aligned with all the moons of Jupiter. This is the entrance to what Clark in his novel of 2001 calls the Stargate. Quote, "That trans-dimensional shortcut across space and time which leads to another universe." Bowman is drawn through the gate. The effects for this sequence relied on a special animation device called the slip scan machine. Extraterrestrials, whatever their nature, provide an elegant environment for Bowman's rebirth. Music by Gheorghe Ligeti may suggest their presence. They stand in their relationship to Bowman as the gods Athena, Hermes, and Zeus stood to Odysseus, preparing him for the cleansing of Ithaca on his preordained return. Human timescales are irrelevant here. Bowman ages, and at the moment of death is confronted with the fourth monolith. Man's last turning point is achieved. The star child is born. He turns his gaze across the abyss of light years to Earth. He is the first of a new breed, and he is headed home. The musical motif, the tone poem, Thus Spake Zarathustra, composed by Richard Strauss in 1895 and named in homage to the brilliant contemporary essay by Friedrich Nietzsche. I mean to convey, Strauss wrote, an idea of the evolution of the human race from its origin through its various phases of development, religious as well as scientific, up to Nietzsche's idea of the Superman. In his essay, Nietzsche muses, what is ape to man? A laughingstock. And just the same shall man be to Superman. Star Child is Superman, not the victor in election or argument come to reform enemies and claim the spoils of war, but the offspring of instructed genetic progress whose way lies beyond the fears and scruples of his ancestors. The groundwork for this optimism that humbles daily goals is ourselves, one generation hence, treated so matter-of-factly in the film that we forget 2001 A Space Odyssey is mostly about our world. In that world, we can only live day by day. And on the same day we walk the moon, we pay the rent. But the longer perspective of science fiction puts us in the myth. An age may come, says Arthur Clarke, when Project Apollo is the only thing by which most men remember the United States, or even the world of their ancestors, the distant planet Earth.
Permission to quote copyright material, The Lost Worlds of 2001 by Arthur Clarke and The Making of Kubrick's 2001 by Jerome Eagle, published by New American Library, and to Frederick I. Ordway, film excerpts courtesy MGM.